En coloc. Une retransmission proposée par Canal Academy.
Welcome to Canal Academy, the French Academic Web Radio. Do you know the L'Oréal UNESCO Awards Women in Science? Created in 1998, the objective is to encourage young women around the world to follow in the scientists' footsteps. In a few moments, you will be able to listen to the recording of the five women prize winner speeches on the 4th March 2009 in the Institut de France in Paris. Each winner comes from each of the five continents: Africa, Asia-Pacific, Europe, Latin America and North America, and receive $1,100. Professor Tebelo Nyokong is laureate for Africa and the Arab states. Professor Nyokong has spent her scientific career working on the synthesis and characterization of a group of related chemical compounds called phthalocyanins, which are most commonly used as dyes for blue jeans. Professor Akiko Kobayashi is laureate for Asia and the Pacific. She studies the design, synthesis, and production of various types of molecular conductors and superconductors. Particularly, she has succeeded in preparing the first metallic crystal consisting of a single kind of neutral molecule. Professor Athene McDonald is laureate for Europe. Athene McDonald's experimental work focuses on soft condensed matter, incorporating polymer and colloidal physics, as well as biological physics. She has used microscopy techniques, X-ray scattering and neutron scattering to study polymers in the native forms, and has been a leader in the development and environmental scanning electron microscopy for such materials. Professor Beatrice Barbai is laureate for Latin America. Beatrice Barbai is an eminent astrophysicist who has made a major contribution to the study of the evolution of the chemical composition of stars. She was the first to demonstrate that metal-poor stars in the galactic halo have an overabundance of oxygen relative to iron, and she is interested in the implications of galaxy formation. She is stranger associate in l'Académie des Sciences. And Professor Eugenia Kumasheva, laureate for North America. She is a world expert in the design, synthesis and fabrication methodology of polymer-based materials that are characterized by multiple structures that have multiple functions. Now listen to the jury president, Ahmed Zeweil, Nobel Prize in Chemistry 1999, strange associate in l'Académie des Sciences. He introduces the communications laureate.
Mr. President, fellow academicians, ladies and gentlemen. First, on behalf of For Women in Science jury, I wish to thank the Academy for hosting this wonderful event here in Paris. I speak as the new president of the jury of For Women in Science Awards. I follow my good friend and the late Nobel laureate Pierre Duchesne, a member of this academy also. The pleasure and the satisfaction of this presidency comes from several facts. First, I believe, like many others, that the core of our human civilization is shaped by the quest for knowledge. In one word, it's science. Without women in science, we are deprived of the contribution of half of this planet Earth's population, roughly 3 billion people. So the world needs science, and science needs women. The second point, the awards are designed to be truly international from 5 continents. And the successful marriage between UNESCO and L'Oréal is a testimony to this global perspective. Indeed, the commitment on both sides is very impressive. Third, I know from experience that the role models make a profound impact. They demonstrate that it is possible to achieve excellence independent of race, sex, or faith. But the task of selecting the most deserving candidates is non-trivial. For this reason, I must acknowledge today the contribution made by the outstanding jury members from five continents. Many of them are here today with us. They diligently examined the nomination of 150 candidates from around the globe. The jury of 14 has four women on the board, and I'm sure as the number of laureates increases, the 50% limit will be reached, hopefully soon. The awards this year mark a new beginning. As you know, the awards used to alternate between life sciences and materials sciences. This year, the scope is broadly defined by all areas of physical sciences, encompassing multidisciplinary research, as you will see today, from matter to stars, and in areas of astrophysics, chemistry, environment, microelectronics, and materials. The 2009 five laureates are honored for their outstanding work in these diverse areas of endeavor. The quest for new knowledge has, for some laureates, uncovered mysteries of our universe, and for other laureates has provided the means for improving human life. You will see today that our laureates from the different corners of the globe have, despite many obstacles, made possible the designs of new materials for drug delivery, the making of novel metals, the visualization of microscopic complex matter, the telescopic reach for 14 billion years from now, and the use of light therapy for human health. It is indeed a great pleasure as the president of the jury to welcome and acknowledge the outstanding contributions of these laureates. And now I wish to call on the individual contributions of each one. The first one is Professor Tobello Nikong, who has actually developed a very novel series of molecules that can be used in cancer therapy and also in cleaning the environment. Please.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction, and thanks for UNESCO and L'Oréal for the award. It's indeed a great honor. Because of the limited time, I'll talk only about the laser treatment of cancer in this particular talk, and I'm going to combine it with the new work that we've been dealing with quantum dots. This treatment of cancer is called photodynamic therapy. It's a mouthful, but we can abbreviate it and call it PDT. This is how photodynamic therapy works. Like any drugs, when it's injected into your body, it goes through all the body, doesn't know where exactly to go. It will clear through the body, and what happens with the molecules we design is that they will then be retained in the cancerous tissue because of the nature of the cancer. Then what happens is laser light is directed to the cancerous tissue, and this has to be red light. And it is the red light that then initiates the treatment by exciting these molecules, generating what we call singlet oxygen or oxygen species that actually kill the cancer. So it's not the dye itself. We call them dyes because they have color, but it is the laser light that initiates the process. So it's a specific treatment. It will only work where the laser light goes and where the dye goes. The whole idea is to try to avoid the effects of chemotherapy, which destroys all cells. Why do we use red light? Red light goes through the body. The other parts of the light will be absorbed by water, whatever you have in the body, while red light can penetrate and go to where the drug is, where it will be absorbed. What do we use this treatment for? It cannot replace, if the cancers are too large, this treatment cannot be used. But it's very useful for inoperable cancers. In South Africa, people suffer from esophageal cancer a lot. One in four male in the rural area suffer from esophageal cancer. Those inoperable cancers, photodynamic therapy will work. It's also good as follow-up treatment. After surgery, you can use this treatment. The advantages include no hair loss, no surgical wounds, there's less trauma and pain, but there's a repeat treatment is possible, outpatient treatment is possible. Now, every treatment has its disadvantages. The disadvantage of this is that if any of the dye stays in the healthy tissue, when you go outside in the sunlight, it will begin to react with the healthy tissue. And this is a major problem for Africa, where in as much as we would really, really like to have cloudy skies like today, the sky is always blue. The molecules that we use for this treatment are actually 50,000 tons or more of them are produced every year. If you are wearing anything blue or green, you are wearing these molecules, but we modify them for medical purposes by changing the central metals. We are chemists by designing what we attach onto them. They are used, as I'm saying, in blue and green dyes, in photocopier machines, in deodorants, in catalysis, and now in photodynamic therapy. The molecule, the central atoms that have been used the most, for those who know the periodic table from somewhere in chemistry first year, is zinc, aluminum, and silicon. And I'll explain why those metals are very important. First of all, we want the dyes to be red absorbing for these applications. And a red absorbing, this is the spectrum, the electromagnetic radiation spectrum. Red absorbing drugs look blue, yet they absorb red. So they should absorb somewhere between 650 and 900 nanometers. That's how we design chemically these molecules. They also must be water soluble, because if you're going to inject the drug into a patient, it must be water soluble and fat soluble at the same time, because once it's in the body, it will get fat. So that the type of molecules we design are negatively charged. They shouldn't be too water soluble. So we have to design them such that they go through the body, they're injected through the body, but otherwise they'll just go straight to the toilet. They need to be retained. So it's a very delicate design of these molecules. They should be non-isomeric. The current drugs are a mixture of a very complicated mixture of molecules. We do not want that, because from batch to batch, you cannot repeat the treatment appropriately. And so by being non-isomeric in our case is that we must, all the periphery of the molecule must be occupied. Then they are not isomeric. But that also has a problem that it makes them too water soluble, and then they just go straight to the toilet. These are isomeric because there are several possibilities in joining this. We really do not want this type of molecule. They must also be monomeric, not aggregated. They must not form clusters. So we design them such that they do not form these clusters. In terms of this chemistry of these molecules, is that we can easily tell when they form clusters by the absorption spectra. This is a very broad absorption spectra they'll show there. When they are monomeric, you see a sharp absorption spectra. But in reality, in the body, once these molecules are injected, when they encounter cells and body fluids, they will disaggregate. This is just done for the study in the lab. And they should give, this is the most important, they should give high triplet yields and lifetime. I'll explain what this means. This is the Jablonski diagram, is a fundamental diagram in photophysics. When you excite the molecule, it goes to what is called a singlet state, and through intersystem crossing, it goes to the triplet state. At this state, the molecules will stay in the nanosecond time scale, not enough to generate singlet oxygen that is necessary for reaction. We want them to be in this state where they can be in millisecond to second lifetime, so there is enough for them to generate the toxic species that will kill the cancer. So it's very important to design those molecules. So they have to have very long triplet yield. This is the sign we use for triplet yield. By large, I mean one. The maximum we are aiming for is one. Triplet lifetime, if it could be in the seconds, it would be nice, but we are happy with milliseconds. The molecules, we've expanded the list because My passion is that we need to have drugs that you have to inject only very little, so that even if there is a bit in the cells, they will not harm the patient because, as I say, in Africa we have very strong sunlight. This region in the periodic table is the most important region for us. These metals have very high yields, close to one, but short lifetimes, but they're also toxic, so we won't inject those into people. This region is very good. Those are the molecules we are looking very carefully at. They have good yields, and they have very long lifetime. But also we can improve the lifetimes by adding surfactants, which simulate what is in the body. You can see the yield goes from 0.61. Remember, we are looking for close to one. They improve when you add medium that is similar to what you get in the body, and the lifetimes also improve. We also want high singlet oxygen counter yield. Remember, the treatment works by exciting the drugs and then using a red laser light. Then the drug transfers energy to oxygen, and it is the toxic oxygen that kills the cancer. So we want, before you can take the molecule for further testing, you must say how much singlet oxygen these molecules generate. This is just the same Jablonski diagram. So the molecules, we want them all here, but when they are here, because our body has oxygen, we breathe it in, we want them to transfer their energy to oxygen to form singlet oxygen. And singlet oxygen is very short-lived. Again, this makes this treatment very specific. It will kill only where singlet oxygen has been, unlike chemotherapy, which goes through the rest of the body. Again, singlet oxygen quantum yield is defined by this symbol. It has to be large. Closer to one, the better. What I've put here is molecule, never mind what is on the side of these molecules. This is the aluminum one. Those who probably didn't like first year chemistry at the moment are wondering what all this is. Has a very long lifetime, moderate yield. It is in clinical trials, but you still need large amounts of it to actually work. Then the germanium one, we thought we could take further. It has very good lifetime, very good yields. But that tells you that all these parameters that you do in the lab don't mean anything sometimes. You still have to go to biology. So we tested this in leukemia cells. It's very good in other ways, but it was toxic without light. This molecule became toxic even before you add light. We then throw it away. It is not applicable. It's got to only react to light. Then we tested some more molecules in esophageal cell, cancer cells, which is very important for us in South Africa. And consistently, we find that the zinc derivatives, when irradiated, are very good in killing these cancer cells. So some of these molecules are in preclinical testing at the moment. Now, lately, what we've done is to combine these molecules with what are called quantum dots. Quantum dots are really very fascinating. They are zero-dimensional. What it means is that they are nano in all three dimensions. Wires are nano in two dimensions. Wells are nano. So it just goes like that. Quantum dots are nano in all dimensions. We call them zero-dimensional material. They are very small. 2 to 10 nanometers, consists of a few atoms. They have fascinating absorption and emission spectrum, which are dependent on their size. So you can really fine-tune them. They are very popular at the moment in biology for biological tagging. People are thinking they can be used for photodynamic therapy. They are also used for photocatalysis. What we plan to do is to combine our dyes, which are blue, with quantum dots. They are highly fluorescent, so it will be very good for imaging of even the smallest cancers possible. So we are linking these two in order to start testing them. We will be testing them. We kind of work with someone in China where we do the test in laboratory animals. This is just showing that the quantum dots, as they grow in size, their spectrum moves. So you can tune. You can decide, I want a quantum dot of this size, depending on the applications. And in this region here, they are already red regions, so they can be used for photodynamic therapy by themselves. They are beautiful colors. I just love looking at them. They fluoresce beautifully. So it's really wonderful drugs to work with, molecules to work with. If you're going to make such small particles, if you do not passivate them, you have to add something to stop them growing. They'll grow into bulk. So we have to passivate them, but we also passivate them carefully because we can use these passivating agents to connect them to biological molecules for tagging, and we can use them, in our case, for thalocyanins to tag them into the cancer cells. Quantum dots, can enter capillaries in cells, particularly in cancer cells. There are dangers associated with this. So in South Africa, there's a whole team now, which I've been asked to develop, which looks into the effects of quantum dots in healthy tissue. Maybe they can actually enter healthy cells, and that is also something we are very conscious about. But before we link them chemically, we just mix them, just in solution, to see whether they affect the behavior of our dyes in photodynamic therapy. This is the kind of results we observe. This is the capping agent, never mind what it is. This is the yield of our molecule. We chose aluminum. The yield without quantum dots is 0.36. Remember, we want this value to increase up to 1. This first one didn't increase very much, or actually decreased a little bit. The others increase. The lifetime in the triplet state, where we want the molecules to be, actually increased. It seems then quantum dots are improving the behavior of our molecules for cancer. But we also want to use quantum dots for imaging. And this is the yields, fluorescence yields of quantum dots. In the absence of thalocyanins, it decreases a little bit, but we find that it is still very useful for imaging purposes. Another thing that is important we have to note about quantum dots, why their fluorescence decreases a little bit, is that in the presence of these molecules, thalocyanins, there is energy transfer from quantum dots to thalocyanins, and we've been studying that. That energy transfer occurs if there is overlap of absorption of our dyes with the emission of quantum dots, energy transfer occurs. Hence, there is a bit of reduction in the emission of quantum dots. And we studied this deliberately by irradiating the thalocyanin in the presence of the quantum dots. Thalocyanins do not absorb in this region, while quantum dots do. And you can see the energy transfer occurring. You see that they lose their energy, and you get an increase in energy where thalocyanins absorb. So they tend to give each other energy. Hopefully that doesn't affect the imaging that we are looking for very much. And what we have done now, in the short time I was allowed to talk, I couldn't go further than this. We have chemically linked some thalocyanins with quantum dots. We are testing this in leukemia cells and esophageal cancer cells. Simultaneously, we are testing them in laboratory animals, in laboratory rats. We obey all the laws, the media. We do obey all the laws. The current quantum dots that we are using are not yet safe for human use, because they contain heavy metals. So the process of developing quantum dots that are not dangerous is still going on. So at the moment, I can summarize and say the drugs that we think will work are in preclinical trials, but we have to train students. So constantly we develop new drugs because there are new students who want to understand this. But we keep going further by linking this to quantum dots and other nanoparticles, and also to gold, because in South Africa, remember, we have gold. And finally, there are lots of people, lots of collaborators in this kind of project, China, Japan, UK, Turkey, South Africa, lots of students are involved, lots of collaborators, one of my collaborators is here, lots of different type of students, and last week we had a big workshop where we had the Japanese, the Canadians, the Germans, all together with my students, to talk about a way forward in this type of treatment. And that is me in my traditional dress, so get used to it. That's all you'll see. And we are fortunate in South Africa to receive lots of funding. To receive funding, and we are very grateful about that. Thank you for your attention.
Next of our laureates, we go from the nanoscale molecules and quantum dots into the nanoscale metals, which opens a whole new window on microelectronics or nanoelectronics. Professor Akiko Kobayashi.
Thank you, Chairman. First, I would like to thank committee members and juries of L'Oréal UNESCO Award for selecting me as an laureate of Asian Pacific region. Until very recently, molecular materials, well, organic materials are thought to be as an insulator. However, without electronic functions. However, nowadays, molecular materials such as liquid crystals and organic EL are thought to be indispensable for our everyday lives. And liquid crystals or organic EL are indispensable for our everyday lives. So liquid crystals were discovered in 19th century, and at that time, no one thought that these liquid crystals are thought to be one century after the electronic devices. It's very important for material chemists who are interested in developing molecular materials. And I have been involved in studying the molecular conductors since the 1970s. And since then, extremely large number of progress has been made, and these works were listed in this very nice reviews by Professor Bataille. And we presented single component molecular metal and magnetic organic superconductors. And this is a first discovery of organic superconductor by Professor Jerome and Professor Bettigard in 1980. It was a very important, and the most important works in the field of molecular conductors. And in this compound, TMTSF is a planar molecule, and it is the frontier orbitals shown here, and TMTSF form a one-dimensional quasi striking structure, and in this columns, carriers are generated by charge transfer between TMTSF and TMS, TSF, and PXX molecule. And another discovery of superconductor is based on the transition metal complex molecule TTF nickel DMT DMIT122 compound. In this compound forms a column structure along this screen, and the charge transfer frontier orbitals are shown here, and frontier charge transfer between the donor and acceptor, their electrons are generated. And this compound has become a superconducting state at 1.5 degree Kelvin. And from this chemical structure analysis, we obtain the requirement for design of molecular metals. Molecular arrangement and frontier more suitable for the band formation and carrier generation by charge transfer between the molecule forming conduction band and other chemical species, there are two requirements for design molecular metals. And so there must be more than two components to construct the molecular metals. Let us consider the single component molecular systems. Anthracene molecule is organic molecule. The molecular scheme is shown here. The below homolumels, the electrons are occupied, and above lumolumels vacant. And homo and lumo energy gap is very large because the intramolecular interaction in this case is very large. And these lumo and homo homes in the crystals, bandwidth is very small because in this molecule, its intermolecular interaction is very small. And as mentioned before, we can, and this bandwidth is very small, thus this homo and lumo energy gap is very large, this compound is insulator. However, as mentioned back, as mentioned before, the we introduce ions, these insulators become metallic. So traditional molecular metals are composed of more than two components. And we know that homo bands and mo bands have an overlap. We can have a metallic band. And there is two ways to make the metallic band. One case is the increase of bandwidth by applying high pressure. And in this case, however, the intramolecular interaction is almost the equal to the that of intramolecular interactions. So in this case, very unusual molecules are produced. The good example is iodine molecule. Iodine molecule becomes a metal and organic superconductor about 30 gigapascal. However, at that stage, molecules are dissociated to iodine atom. So it is very difficult to obtain the single component metal by applying high pressure. Another method is decreasing of the homo-lumo gap by suitable molecular design. We synthesize this nickel TMDT. This molecule, the central metal atom is nickel, and this ligand is, has many sulfur atoms, and this is a famous donor TTF parts. And we know this homo and lumo the linear combination of the left side ligand MO and the right side ligand MO, or the linear combination of YL plus YL, and LUMO is antibody combination of YL minus YL. And this compound is metallic down to low temperature. Three-dimensional Fermi surfaces were confirmed by the quantum oscillations, Duhasz-Van-Alphen oscillations. Automatic generation of the carriers produced by self-assembling the molecules is far from the idea of the traditional molecular metals. So we synthesized first single component molecular metal. We replacing the central metal atom to other metal atoms, such as gold and other metal atoms. And we obtained gold TMDT as an anti-ferromagnetic metal with transition temperature is 110 degrees Kelvin. And this transition temperature is very high compared to those transition temperature of the usual organic magnetic molecules, conductors. And it is metallic down to from room temperature to down to very low temperatures. So for the coexistence of the magnetic moment and pi electrons of coexisting this molecule, it is a very interesting molecule. And ab initio bond structure calculation predicted that the spin density of these molecules on the left side ligand and right side ligand, the spin density is distributed in one molecule, and around the central metal atom, the spin density almost nothing. This predict that, this calculation predict that this molecule, its anti-ferromagnetic state is very stable. When we dispersed the powder samples of gold TMDT to organic solvent, we can obtain the microcrystals of gold TMDT. And this molecule is long molecules, and so we could obtain the nanometal plate. And usually, nanoparticles are spheres, and the gold or palladium, such a nanoparticle, is unstable when uncoated by the organic molecules. However, this molecule is very stable in the air. The development of the fabrication is very important to electric circuits. So the nanoparticles or nanowires we obtain from this nanometal plate if the processing techniques will be improved in near future. And unlike the spherical particles, this nanometal plate is very stable. So we use these kind of metal TMDT molecules. If the manipulation technique will be increased in future, we can arrange the metal atoms, molecules like this. We arrange molecules like this, face-to-face stacking. In this case, this molecule has a home band, room band, parallel bands. In this case, is metallic bands obtained. And another case, if we arrange the molecules like a sleeping overlap mode, we can obtain the home bands, room bands, form the crossing bands. This case is insulator or semiconductor. So we can systematically control these molecular arrangement, we can obtain, we can change the physical properties of these compounds. Single component molecular metals are developed very recently, and a little known about it. I hope that these materials will be important, play an important role in the material science and technology. These are the collaborators. I would like to thank all these collaborators. Thank you for kind attention.
Okay, from making materials and making controlling matter, now into Professor Athene Donald from Cambridge, who actually make it possible to visualize the world of complexity, as you will see.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the invitation and the award of the prize. And this is an amazing room to speak in. It's quite fascinating. So what I want to do today is sort of explain what my citation means, because the citation saying I study messy materials perhaps doesn't convey a great deal of what I want to do. So I'd like to explain this. These are the two different citations, the one for the lay audience and the one for the scientists. And they're really describing the same thing. So one is the techniques that I use, electron microscopy, X-ray scattering, applied to the field of soft matter physics, which is the sort of the technical way of describing the messy materials that I work on. And I'm going to try and illustrate the sorts of things I do using some of my recent work on protein aggregation, because it gives me an opportunity to bring together a lot of the different ideas. So protein aggregation turns up in many different guises. I actually approached it myself from having been working on various foods. And I started working on proteins like beta-lactoglobulin, which is a protein from milk, it's a whey protein, and studying the aggregation, which is used to convey structure onto food, so things like yogurt, you control the aggregation. But it's actually exactly the same process in a certain sense, and I'll explain in what sense, that turns up in many important neurodegenerative diseases, such as Alzheimer's disease. So again, what happens in that case is the proteins which have a function in the body, they change their conformation, they change their shape, they partially unfold, and that enables them to stick together. Now, you might think there's absolutely no connection between studying yogurt and brain disease, but in fact, as a physicist, what I try to do is to look for the unifying themes. I'm not a biochemist. I probably couldn't draw the sequence of the proteins that I'm interested in, and I'm going to try and concentrate on the physicist's approach to this, try to look for the universal behavior so that I can see the connections between these very different materials. So here, this is an electron micrograph, not in fact taken by me, of the typical structure of the amyloid diseases. Amyloid diseases arise because the proteins stick together inappropriately, for instance, in the brain, and they form long fibrils known as amyloid fibrils. And so this is a sort of gross morphology. The fibrils are maybe many microns in length and a few nanometers in width. This is the packing of the protein molecules. The arrows represent beta sheets. They stack together in a very regular way, and they have characteristic spacings which you can detect for X-ray diffraction, for instance. Now, that's the kind of protein aggregation that has been most extensively studied and is thought to be highly relevant to the disease states. But it's not the only way in which proteins can aggregate. And we've been exploring other forms of aggregate which are also pretty ubiquitous, as it turns out. So if I take the example of beta-lactoglobulin, this whey protein from milk, and you look at the structures that form as you change the pH. So the isoelectric point for beta-lactoglobulin is at 5.13, a pH of 5.13. That means the point at which there is no net charge on the protein. And here, it's been known for many years that a structure known as particulate gels form, and I'll say a bit more about those shortly. Away from this point, either in more acid or towards neutral conditions, you get what are called fine-stranded gels, where you see these long fibrils forming, and these have recently been shown to be exactly equivalent in structure to the amyloid fibrils that I mentioned in the case of neurodegenerative diseases. But even that is not the end of the story, and we discovered a different form of protein aggregation which consists of aggregates of the fibrils. So it's a suprafibrillar aggregate, giving rise to this characteristic structure seen here in the polarized light micrograph, a so-called spherulitic structure. And again, we believe this is a ubiquitous kind of phenomenon. So if I start looking at what happens around the isoelectric point, as I say, that's the condition in which there is no net charge on the protein. And it's been well known in beta-lactoglobulin that you get these structures forming. They're essentially spherical particles, pretty close to monodispersed, so they're more or less the same size, all of them. And people have tried to find mechanisms for how these form, taking specific bits of information about the beta-lactoglobulin molecule. But in fact, what we believe happens is simply that you have no net charge on the proteins. The proteins have been heated up to denature them, so you've unfolded the proteins, and then they can stick together. And there is absolutely no reason why that should be anything specific to this particular protein. And so we looked at a whole range of different proteins around their isoelectric point. So again, choosing the pH condition where there was no net charge, beta-lactoglobulin, bovine serum albumin, bovine insulin, horse heart, myoglobin, hen egg white, lysozyme, and human transferrin. It doesn't matter what these proteins are, but essentially you can find conditions. You heat them up around the isoelectric point, and they will all form exactly the same kind of structures, which implies to me as a physicist that this is some universal behavior. It is not related to the specific amino acid sequence, but it is something that is much more to do with the fact that we have a long molecule. I come from a background of working on synthetic polymers, so these are long chain molecules. There is no net charge. There may be local charge, so there may be some electrostatic interactions, but essentially they are capable of sticking together in a quasi-random way to give these near monodispersed particles. Now, we wanted to study what controlled the size of these particles. And so we wanted to be able to measure their sizes accurately. If you use conventional scanning electron microscopy, which people have done in the past, you have to work in high vacuum conditions. These are systems that are aggregating in aqueous systems. The water is part of their structure. The water is bound in with the protein. And therefore, you need to find different ways of looking at the structures that do not dehydrate the sample, because if you dehydrate something, you are likely to change it. So we've been using a technique known as environmental scanning electron microscopy, which we have been working on for about 15 years now. And this is a sort of variant of the conventional electron microscope. You have the same electron source at the top. You have a sample chamber down here. You have various lenses to focus the beam. But what is different is that you have a series of pressure-limiting apertures down the column. And around the sample itself, you can keep saturated water vapor present, for instance. So you can keep gas in the chamber. You just have a very limited path through which the electrons have to travel so that you don't have too much electron scattering, which is why normally you work in high vacuum, but you can keep the sample hydrated. And that means that for things like our protein aggregates, you can keep the bound water in there. Now, there's another advantage of having gas molecules present in the sample, and that is that if you start to analyze what happens, you are forming an image with the electrons emitted from the sample. The electrons travel through this region where there are gas molecules. You will get ionization events, so you'll get positive ions forming, which can migrate back to the sample surface and neutralize the charge buildup that normally arises because of the electron beam hitting the sample. And so you don't have to coat the sample surface with gold or some other conductor, which again is something that is usually done. So there's an added benefit for looking at any kind of insulator, and we've done a lot of work on different kinds of insulators. And I'll come back and show you some of the different kinds of systems we've looked at the end. But in the context of the protein aggregation, this gives you a way of being able to study the size of the particles that form under different conditions. So here we have, as a function of the temperature to which we heat our protein solution, we're plotting the particle radius that forms, and you can see that above a certain temperature, the particle size is essentially independent of the temperature to which you go. But if you only go to a more modest temperature, at first sight, if you look at these red dots here, at first sight it looks like there's a peak, and then the particle size falls off at lower temperatures. This is actually a function of the way we did the experiment. We simply took our samples up and held them for 10 minutes at this temperature. And at high temperature, 10 minutes is long enough to reach an equilibrium value. At lower temperatures, the kinetics are slower, so you have to wait much longer to establish equilibrium. So if you want to try and work out a mechanism by which these particles form and by which they grow, you've really got to think quite hard about how you do the experiment to make sure you've established equilibrium. Now, the literature on beta-lactoglobulin would say that these spherical particles are essentially amorphous. The amyloid fibril that I mentioned earlier, that this fibrillar structure that forms the basis of neurodegenerative diseases, is well known to have specific spacings that you can see in the X-ray diffraction. But the assumption was that these spherical particles were amorphous. We did some so-called small-angle X-ray scattering at the European Synchrotron Research Facility in Grenoble. And what you do in an experiment like this is, instead of looking at the very short length scales that you would get in a normal X-ray crystallography experiment, you're looking at larger length scales. And you can look at the plots, and I don't have time to explain how you extract information from these, but essentially from the slope of these plots, you can work out something about a quantity known as the fractal dimension. This quantity here, D sub F. And what this does is it relates the volume of your object to its characteristic dimension. And if you have a sphere, then the fractal dimension is 3. It just tells you that volume is proportional to the radius cubed, which you would all know. If you have a linear structure, if it's just something like a fibril, then the fractal dimension is 1. You're just saying that it's the volume is proportional to its length. And what we did, we looked at the scattering under different conditions. As I say, I don't have time to explain this in any detail, but what we have here, if you have no salt present in the solution, you look at the local value of the fractal dimension, and you find that you get a value for this of approximately unity, which implies that in this sample, which overall is spherical, you have something which appears to be linear. So what have I told you about that might be linear? Well, the obvious answer is that you have something that is fibrillar. So we believe that within this overall amorphous structure, which is hundreds of nanometers across, you have local packing of things that are fibrillar, i.e. that are related to the amyloid structure that I mentioned earlier and that has a high content of beta sheet. So our image is that you have overall, and just concentrate on this left-hand image, and my laser pointer seems to have, the battery seems to have died. The left-hand image shows an overall amorphous entity with no overall orientation, but within it we have linear structures, short runs of high beta sheet content and a fibrillar structure. And we can do various other tests to confirm that is so. So again, in terms of looking at universal behavior, what we have is this beta sheet structure that underlay the neurodegenerative diseases is actually turning up in this very different condition. I also said that amyloid fibrils could themselves aggregate into larger scale structures. Now, in terms of the diseases, it's actually thought that the amyloid fibrils that you would see in the postmortem of a brain are not the toxic species. The toxicity occurred at an earlier stage, and you're just seeing what's happened when the aggregation occurs. But you can also, if you look in diseased brains, you can see here spherulitic structures forming. These are from brain slices of an Alzheimer's patient. You have a very characteristic structure. These are now optical micrographs with particular conditions of setting up the microscope. But you get very much the same structure in lots of disease states, as we see now working with insulin, another easy protein for a physicist to work with, in vitro, so just looking at it in a test tube, allowing aggregation to occur. And you see these spherulitic structures forming, which are formed from aggregates of the fibrillar structures. And we can characterize the packing in various ways. This upper picture, again, is optical. We've now inserted a wave plate, and we can characterize the orientation of whatever is doing the aggregation. If we put in the wave plate and look at the fast axis of it and compare it with what happens in an aligned solution, yellow says that it's aligned along the fast axis, blue is that it's perpendicular, and you can see that you have a radially oriented structure in these insulin spherulites. You can also kind of see that in the environmental SEM image down here. You can see a hint of the radiating structures, and the center of the spherulite would be way down here somewhere. So what you have here are radially oriented fibrillar structures, so that we can draw a picture highly schematically that looks like this. Something has nucleated these spherulites. We don't know what the nucleation event is. And the fibrils grow out. Misfolded protein from the solution will come and add on to the end of the spherulite, and the whole thing will grow out. And the basic building block is, again, this fibrillar structure. That's exactly the same structure as in the free amyloid fibrils. And we've done quite a lot of work modelling the growth. As I say, we don't understand the nucleation event, but we do know that the activation energy for the growth of the fibrils in a spherulite is exactly the same as the activation energy for free fibril growth. Now, let me come back to my original thesis, which is that as a soft matter physicist, I'm always trying to make connections between different things. And that strikes me as what I'm good at, not knowing the details of anything highly specific, but bringing together ideas from lots of different fields. So if I stay with this theme of spherulites a bit longer, if you took a polythene bag and put it under cross polarizers, this is what you would see, exactly the same optical structure of spherulites. And we did work on polyethylene spherulites a number of years ago. More recently, I worked on starch, as was mentioned in the citation. If you look at starch granules, so these are the things you would tease out, in this case from potato, you tease out the granules, you will again see this spherulitic structure. And I worked on starch for many years and used small-angle X-ray scattering to study it. And what you get, this again, is small-angle scattering. So you're looking at information about local packing on different length scales. And what We have here a very strong peak occurring at a distance of about 9 nanometers. We found that peak persisted at that length scale in just about every species of starch. So we looked at starches from all around the world, modified starches that the plant biochemists were playing with, knocking out bits of the enzymatic production route. Yet this repeat was pretty well constant, and we tried to find some physical explanation because the plant biochemists told us there was no biochemical explanation for it. So we can take a curve like this, which appears not to have a huge amount of information in it, and we can fit that using a mathematical model I won't bore you with, but you can fit it together using a three-phase model, three different kinds of region within this granule, which is what you would pull out of an ear of wheat or a potato tuber or whatever. And the three different regions are alternating crystalline and amorphous lamellae, and I'll show you a schematic of this in a minute, embedded in an amorphous growth ring. Now, the amorphous growth ring is what is the signature of this low-angle region, and this is thought to arise from some kind of diurnal fluctuation, whereas this is associated with the way the one of the polysaccharides in starch is laid down, the amylopectin. So, as a physicist, I can produce a really naive picture of what my starch granule looks like. So it's an overall large object of many microns across, and it has different regions present. It has this amorphous growth ring, which is at spacings of thousands of nanometers, and embedded in that are these alternating regions of crystal and amorphous material. And these crystalline lamellae are made of a highly branched molecule in starch known as amylopectin, which forms double helical regions joined to some backbone, and the place where it joins, the branch points, are what form the amorphous lamellae. And this picture you can now use to try and explain the differences between different starches. So if you are trying to understand why potato might be good for one use and wheat for another, never mind about eating it, but if you're trying to make a coating for wallpaper, for instance, which starch is heavily used for, then you can start trying to relate it to this kind of physical model, and you can talk to the plant biochemists, and you can talk to the people who are doing the processing and try to bring those different strands of the story together. And again, we can see the same kind of picture of structures radiating out, only now what is radiating out are the long amylopectin molecules forming these double helical regions of crystal. Now, finally, let me end up with some of the work we've been doing on environmental SEM, again looking at wildly different kinds of sample types, some of which were mentioned in the citation. What we're trying to do here, we are developing the technique, we are trying to understand the physics of the image formation, how to control the atmosphere in the chamber to give us the control we need over doing an experiment. So here we have cement hydration. If you take grains of cement and hydrate in situ, you can change the amount of water present in the chamber, you can follow the reactions, and you can relate that to other processes that are known, other means of studying this. We've done a lot of work watching paint dry. To the English-speaking audience, watching paint dry is always described as something really boring. And I like to say to people, well, I do watch paint dry, and it's actually extremely interesting. So what you have here are the small particles in a paint which are coming together to aggregate, and you want to be able to watch that process in situ so that you can follow how the paint film forms, and then maybe say something about the opacity or its wear resistance and things like that. So we work quite closely with industry on materials like that. And we've done, again, in the food context, we've done work looking at vegetables, looking at the texture of vegetables, modelling how they form here. We're driving a knife into a carrot, and you can literally see the juice squirting out. But more importantly, you can start looking at how the internal structure of the carrot collapses and how the juice will spread. And you can look at that, for instance, as a function of processing conditions if you've cooked it or whatever. Most recently, we've done a lot of work moving into more biological situations. So we've been trying to see if you can use this technique to look at living organisms. So normally you would kill anything biological in the electron microscope, either because you've dehydrated it or because you've hit it really hard with the electron beam. We've established that for instance, E. coli bacteria, you can keep them viable in the electron microscope. So in principle, we could now start to watch infection processes with living organisms. We haven't gone that far yet. And we're also starting to look at mammalian cells, which undoubtedly you do kill in the electron beam, but nevertheless, you can get novel information about structure. And this is a fibroblast. It's just a cell line, but you can do a lot of neat things with biological systems because you can keep the sample hydrated. So what I hope I've been able to show you is that although I work on many different systems and they may be described as messy, there are lots of connections you can make between them. You can use a common set of tools and a common set of approaches that are really the approaches of soft matter physics that give you ways of analyzing really quite unfamiliar systems and systems that physicists may not normally think are appropriate. I like to work in a multidisciplinary way. I've mentioned working with plant biochemists. I work with people from our vet school on the E. coli, lots of different ways. And for me, that's the fun of being able to make these connections, learn new things. Moving into different areas gives you lots of new challenges, which is always good to keep us awake. But I hope I'm always a practicing physicist at heart. And of course, there's a whole myriad of people who've actually done the work, generations of students who've gone on into industry, into other academic positions. And I'd like to thank them for making me be able to win this prize. Thank you very much.
Actually, Professor Donald comes from Cambridge, and there is tremendous tradition there in electron microscopy over the last half a century or so. So it's not surprising to see this wonderful contribution here. Now, you heard so far on the microscopic world. We went from atoms and metals and nanostructures and cellular structures. Now we're going to go to the very large, the largest in our universe. Well, not the largest really, but very large, stars. We're going to look now at stars and go back in time for tens of billions of years. And it's a great honor to introduce Professor Patrice Berbe.
Thank you very much. I'm very honored to be here at the Académie des Sciences, of which I have the great honor to be an associate member. I'm very thankful to the L'Oréal for this initiative, to the UNESCO for the collaboration with L'Oréal with this important initiative. I think it's also important to point out that it's done by continent, which I think it's very fair, because the conditions of work are not the same in the different continents. And I'm also very grateful to the jury, distinguished jury members. I'm going to talk about the old stars, formation and evolution of the galaxy. I try to make a summary of the work on I have been doing on chemical elements in stars and galaxies. This picture was prepared by the WMAP team. This is a satellite that was launched to bring information on the cosmic background radiation. And I show it because it shows that we had first the Big Bang, then you have processes in the very early universe like inflation, quantum fluctuations, which is very complicated, and very energetic phase. Then you have dark ages, where you have nothing happening, nothing detectable. And then you have the formation of stars. It's from now on that we are working on, this is our work to know what are the first stars and which are the oldest stars that we can observe. And then you have evolution of the universe and formation of galaxies, and the continuous formation of stars. Today we know that where the elements formed and continue to form. In the Big Bang, only hydrogen, helium, and traces of lithium, beryllium, and boron were formed. So all the rest of the elements are formed in the interiors of stars. from carbon to uranium, and lithium and helium are also partly produced in stars. And the first generation of stars was never observed, but should be detected in two ways. The very massive star that exploded 10 billion years ago, 14 billion years ago, they should be observable today, because when they explode, they are so bright, they are brightest than all the rest of the universe today. So they are detected as very strong, energetic gamma ray bursts. There have been a few, especially one in 2004 that was detected, and there are satellites looking for another of these events. Otherwise, the very low mass first or second generation of stars should still exist, but the first generation of stars should have zero metals, and none of these zero metal stars was detected, but stars with as low as 100,000 less metal than the Sun were already detected. This is another view of the evolution. So you have the Big Bang, then you have the early universe, and then you have the first stars in this plot that should be massive stars. It's nowadays believed that the first stars, either they collapse as black holes, either they become very powerful supernova, ejecting the first materials in the universe, and then you have reionization of the universe. Then you don't form stars in this period very much. And then you start to form the first galaxies and the stars that we observe today. And the oldest stars that we can observe have imprinted in their chemical composition the products of the previous generation of supernova, in particular the first generation of supernova. The concept of supernova, it's important to tell that there are main kinds of supernovae. Supernova type 2 that have more than 10 times the mass of the Sun, and they enrich very strongly in the so-called alpha elements. Alpha is the helium nuclei, and multiples of alphas are called alpha elements, like oxygen 16, magnesium 24, silicon 28, calcium 40, titanium 48. Whereas supernova type 1 are less massive and they enrich mostly in iron. So if you have, as I'm going to show, a star with a lot of oxygen and not much iron, this shows that this star was mostly enriched by supernova type 2. Supernova type 2 exploded in about 1 million years, whereas supernova type 1 exploded in about 1 giga year. So there is a time lag between the two. So it makes that when a star forms just after the supernova type 2, it has excesses of alpha elements. And that we see in stars, in old stars, also in galaxies, external galaxies. Our work consists in comparing observations. We observe spectra in big telescopes. In general, we prefer very high resolution when it's possible. And we compare with synthetic spectra, theoretically computed. And we compare the two, and then we deduce what is the content of the star. This is an example. You have this spectrum here. It's quite a good spectrum that you see. It's below the dots, which is the observed spectrum, you have the calculations. For example, for the oxygen line, you have three calculations with three abundances. So we determine which is the oxygen abundance that fits the observed line. The ultimate goal is to understand the formation of the galaxy and the nucleosynthesis process that occurred since then, the evolution, chemical evolution of the galaxy. This is a cartoon illustrating the formation of our galaxy. You have first gas, not very organized, and then you start to form the halo of the galaxy and the bulge, the central part. Then you collapse in the disk, you have the disk, you have the halo with full of stars and the galactic bulge in the center. And then the disk grows and forms the arms, and the sun is in one of the arms. This is another cartoon showing how is our galaxy. We have the galactic bulge, the halo, and the disk. We study mostly the galactic halo, the metal poor stars, and the galactic bulge, where there are mostly metal-rich stars, but also metal-poor ones. And the first one important result obtained in 1988 was that oxygen is overabundant, no stars in the halo, and this is shows that in the early times you had a lot of supernova type 2 very early and very fast. You formed a star just after that. And this was confirmed in a big project that we had with a very large telescope at the European Southern Observatory for fainter stars. And it was confirmed that the oxygen is always overabundant with an excess until very low metallicities, until then 10,000 less the solar metallicity. Another important result within the same project was the detection of uranium. I realized that there is great interest in dating stars. This is one of the ways. I'm going to show another way. This small line here is the uranium line, which is a radioactive element. So if you determine uranium to thorium, you can determine the age of the star. This was the first time that it was done for a star. So we also work with the globular clusters. These are groups of 1 million stars, beautiful objects, and they are old. They are among the oldest objects in the galaxy. If you observe all those stars and you plot their brightness in one color, for example, visible, and the difference of two brightnesses in two colors, you get this diagram. It's a well-known diagram. You can also derive ages from this diagram because the evolution of stars from being a dwarf to be a giant is computed in theoretical calculations with good precision, so you can compare the calculations to these diagrams and derive the age of these objects. And one important result that we got also was that in the galactic bulge in the center of the galaxy, even metal-poor, metal-rich globulars, they are also very old, nearly as the halo. This is another example of a small line that we fit. This is for the sun. We fit for the sun, for a well-known star called Arcturus, and then the very faint star that we observed with the very large telescope. And we found out that there is a group of about 10 globular clusters that are very, very old, probably the oldest objects in the galaxy. They are rather metal-rich, and they have a diagram like the one just showed before that shows a very old age. Finally, we also have been computing spectra, so we developed a grid of data, of atomic and molecular data, and we were able to compute a grid of spectra and to compute spectra of ensemble of stars. And we can apply this to galaxies. And galaxies, this is well known, but we also found magnesium enhancement, again an alpha element, magnesium enhancement in galaxies. In particular, we worked with groups, compact groups of galaxies. These are groups containing about 10 galaxies. And we found that there is a high magnesium, but that does not follow the general law that the magnesium goes together with the mass. But instead, in these cases, it goes down with the mass, indicating there was a truncation of star formation in their centers. So this is ongoing work. We also, more recently, you are dealing with integral field analysis, which is 1,500 optical fibers you put in the you observe in the center of a galaxy, and you have spectra for 1,500 spectra along the this image. It's an imaging spectroscopy, and in particular, we have a project to do this for the nearby galaxy, and this is a first study that showed that in the very center of this galaxy, it's an elliptical galaxy, you have metal poor star in the very center, then you have and very old, then you have medium ages and more metal rich and two metallicities, and then you have higher metallicity and young age. So you have layers of stellar population. So it's more complicated, more complex than, it's not a homogeneous population. Finally, a few of the main questions that we are working on and that are interesting to follow are the formation of R elements, the heavy elements like europium. We don't know very well how they formed, and we can observe them, and we would like to understand better. So there is interaction with theoreticians and nucleosynthesis experts. And also carbon in the metal poor stars, because it was found that many of the very metal poor stars have a lot of carbon. This is not understood yet either. We also would like to understand better the first stars and the re-ionization of the universe. And the next generation space telescope, James Webb Space Telescope, probably will bring results on that. Then the moderately metal poor globules in the galactic bulge could be the oldest population. We don't know formed when, in which conditions. We don't know very well how the bulge formed. So the formation of bulges is another issue, very important. Finally, the merging of galaxies and truncation of star formation, because it's well, people believe now that the small galaxies merge with bigger galaxies, and they have some effect on the truncation of star formation. And finally, we also have been obtaining new evidence for molecular and atomic data. For example, we got a very long exposure time for the uranium star that I showed before with Hubble Space Telescope that we are analyzing. That should bring news not only on the star, but also on the lines that are particular in this star. So thank you very much.
Last but not least is Professor Eugenia Kumacheva, and she is going to take us into the real thing for our life. We all like to have drugs delivered into the specific target, and Eugenia is going to show us how brilliantly she can design molecules to do so.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank the jury for selecting me as a laureate from the North America, and also join other speakers in thanking for the opportunity to speak in this wonderful room and for this audience. I'll be talking about new functional materials, and this brings me to this diagram, because as scientists, we like to think in terms of graphs and diagrams, and actually this diagram reflects a long way to material science. I had my first degree in chemical engineering, where I got an idea about really practical things and chemical engineering and technology, and then I did my PhD in chemistry and then postdoc in physics, and all this gave me a flavor for material science. And finally, I realized that this is what I want to do, but not as alchemists mixing things, hoping that something will come up, but in a very pragmatic and thoughtful way. And today, because of the lack of time, I decided to give a survey of several former projects that we had in our group and several ongoing projects that I hope will be giving us really wonderful results. So one of the first projects is actually not about drug delivery, though I'm going to talk about drug delivery, but actually about polymer materials for optical data storage. A while ago, Bill Gates said that, and I give his quotation, that 640 kilobytes will be enough for everybody. And now, these days, 25 years after he said that, we know that there is a real battle for high density data storage. And there are two ways to achieve this, not talking about quantum computing, by using magnetic data storage and optical data storage. And optical data storage gives us the ability to go in third dimension. And this is where our materials can be useful. So actually, there is the approach that we developed a while ago, which we call a core shell approach to periodically nanostructured materials. We always work with polymer-related materials, even if we work with quantum dots or inorganic materials, there is always a polymer component there. So here we were synthesizing polymer particles that had a size a little bit smaller than a micron, say half micron, and these particles had a core shell structure. And the intrinsic feature of these particles was that they had a rigid core and a somewhat softer shell. But at the room temperature, they interacted via solid body interactions. So the shell was softer and the core was rigid. And then by using the methods of self-assembly, we are arranging them in one, two, or three-dimensional arrays that had a periodic structure. And then we heated them or annealed them at the temperature that was between the glass transition temperature of the core and the shell. So what happened is the shell-forming material became soft and it formed the matrix. And the rigid cores remained as embedded particles in this matrix. This method led us to several ways in controlling their structure and composition of these materials. We call them structural and compositional variables of core shell strategy. For example, we were able to control the particle number density from 10 to the 12 to 10 to the 16th per centimeter cubic just by changing the size of cores and the thickness of shells. We were able to make shells thick, and in this way we were producing materials that were void-free, or we were able to make them thin, and in this way the shells were sintered and we had small voids that could be later infiltrated with other functional materials, for example, inorganic materials. We were able to make multi-component materials, but having two, three, and more shells. And all together, we could make cores inorganic and shells from different polymers that were conductive or semiconducting. Or we can load various functionalities in cores, shells, or in both of them, for example, quantum dots or dyes or nonlinear optics materials. So all together, we could actually calculate how many possible combinations we could have. For example, we can have two polymer materials for the cores and the shells, and say two low molecular weight materials for the cores and the shells. And this gave us 2^4, 16 possible combinations. Or we can go to, say, three polymers and two low molecular weight components, and we could make 32 materials. So, of course, we did not try all of this because we are taking a very pragmatic approach in our work. We conceptualize what we want to achieve, and then we think how to design these materials, how to synthesize them, and how to fabricate them. So the first approach was how to make light-sensitive materials periodic structure. So we made polymer cores from polymethyl methacrylate and polymer shells from the copolymer of polymethyl methacrylate with polybutyl methacrylate. So we tuned very nicely the softening temperature of the shells. And then we labeled the core with the dye-labeled monomer, and I will briefly call it NBD. So we made the cores fluorescent. And when we fabricated our material, we had a very nice array of fluorescent beads that were periodically embedded in the optically inert matrix. And this is the structure taken by confocal microscopy, the surface of this material. You see very nice fluorescent particles. And this is the structure of the materials about 100 microns below the surface. And you can see that this nice periodic structure is preserved. So actually we made a polymer photonic crystal in which we had fluorescent particles in the matrix that had didn't have optical activity. So every single particle, in our view, could behave as a pixel or as a bit of information. And we hypothesized that if we quench fluorescent of a single particle, we'll record information in 3D. And we were using, in collaboration with my colleague, Professor Miller, we were using two-photon excitation and photobleaching of individual fluorescent particles. And this is a two-photon cross-section, which has dimensions, lateral dimension of about 0.5 microns. And if we divide the wavelength that we use by two, we will get the absorption wave, the excitation wavelength of about 420 nanometers. So actually we had to have double matching. We had to make these particles equal to the lateral dimension of a two-photon cross-section, and we had to find the dye that has absorption that is approximately similar to the excitation wavelength. And when we did it, we were able to locally photobleach or record information on these fluorescent particles. So this hole or spectral hole is actually a photobleached particle. The particle is still there, but we quench fluorescence in this spot. And we can actually monitor how we are photobleaching, how we are quenching fluorescence. So very roughly, we needed 20 milliseconds to reduce fluorescence intensity by a factor of two. Later, we went to just 1 millisecond. And because our material was periodic, we could write a software and tell our laser beam to photobleach every second or every third particle, and actually we were recording gratings, and this is the variation of fluorescence intensity. So the well corresponds, the wells correspond to photobleached particles, and we were able to record information in the first layer. Unfortunately, because of the asymmetric shape of two-photon cross-section, we are slightly affecting the third layer here, this particle, and the fifth layer was intact, as shown here. So the storage density here was 10 to the 12, approximately 10 to the 12 bits per centimeter cubic in 3D versus about 10 to the 8 bits per centimeter cubic in 2D, which was really a great advancement. We also did modeling of the imaging process and compared the recording in the homogeneous medium versus the nanostructured material. I will not go in details. I just want to say that because of the optically inert space between the particles, we were able to avoid crosstalk between the recorded bits, and in this way achieve a much higher signal-to-noise ratio, as it is shown here, in comparison with homogeneous material, which means that we could put closer the spots that where we were recording and increase the density storage by a factor of two. Later, we realized that because our material is ordered, we can actually do a Fourier transform recovery of the recorded information and exceed the relay limit in recording data. So from this, we moved to other materials that were conceptualized for biometrics. As we all know, these days, it is very important to create materials that will provide storage of secure information. And in this sense, biometrics, the way to record specific features, characteristic features for a particular holder of identification documents, such as photographs or signatures or fingerprints, becomes very important. And we extended our approach to the synthesis of multi-layer particles in which every layer contained a different dye, UV, visible, and near-IR dye. Unfortunately, here we cannot see, but the outer shell is optically inert. So the number of modes in which we could do information encoding scales as 2 to the power n, where n is the number of photosensitizers. So if you had three dyes, we could actually use three modes in data recording. And this is the cartoon of our material. And these are fluorescence confocal fluorescence microscopy images. So if we use blue light, we can see only hole, only cores, and this is shown here. Two other dyes remain optically inert if we use this particular wavelength. If you are using visible light, we can see this green shell, and this is shown here. If you are using EIR light, we see only the red shell, and this is shown here. So this was all nice, and now we could increase intensity of irradiation and record by photobleaching one dye at a time. So we are actually using selective photobleaching. And these are the features that we were addressing. This is a fingerprint. We recorded it by increasing fluorescence intensity of radiation and photobleaching blue dye. This is my picture. We actually took a picture and transformed it in digital format, and we recorded it by using photobleaching of the green dye. And this is the signature. This is the my name written in Russian, and we photobleached it by using the red dye. All these features are spatially overlapped. So actually we are recording information on the same spot, but we can read it selectively by using a well-defined conditions, a well-defined wavelength. Moreover, because we were using three different dyes, we could write information in RGB format, in red, green, and blue. And this is, again, a digital picture of my colleague, and we were recording this by using photobleaching of the blue, green, and red dye. And when we compiled everything, we got a picture, a color picture. We, of course, we are using grayscales of my colleague, but it was written in the nanostructured material. So this is so far about optical data storage, and now we are working, extending this work towards recording in 3D and encrypting really complicated information for Ministry of Migration or Ministry of Health. The next project is actually about site-specific delivery of anti-cancer drugs. So we are not working with specific molecules. We are working with drug delivery carriers, and in this particular case, we are using with polymer microgels. And again, our approach was very pragmatic. We wanted to deliver anti-cancer drugs directly to malignant cells, and therefore, we bioconjugated our microgels with apatransferrin that has recognition for the receptors on malignant cells. And we had two types of microgels. The first one was used for fast drug delivery. It carried molecules, carboxylic groups, that at pH of the bloodstream were deprotonated, and the gel was large. These black dots correspond to the drug. So when these microgels are incorporated in cells, actually they are uptaken by endocytosis. In the cell interior, the value of pH is about 4.5 or 5. These carboxylic groups get protonated and the microgel shrinks. And when it shrinks, it releases or squeezes out the drug. So basically, this anti-cancer drug that potentially has very strong side effects is delivered to the cell where it is rapidly released. In a different approach, we were using microgel carriers that had quaternary ammonium chitosan derivatives. This is a biological polymer. And in this particular case, this molecule gets protonated in the cells, and therefore it expands, it gets charged, and therefore the drug is released. And this is what we call by diffusion, and this is what we call prolonged drug release. And again, these tiny hairs on the surface of a microgel correspond to the biological molecules that are used for specific drug delivery in a cell interior. So we proved that these particles were delivered in the cells, and this is the optical microscopy image of HeLa cells, and this is a fluorescence microscopy image of HeLa cells, and we see that the microgels are inside the cells. Actually, here we're using quantum dots just for the imaging purposes. And this is my favorite slide because it shows that we can deliver different types of anti-cancer drugs. In this particular case, we were using a cationic drug, doxorubicin, and in this case, we were using an anionic drug, methotrexate disodium. And we incorporated this drug in chitosan microgels, and we did many control experiments, but this is the main one. Here we were using microgels that were bioconjugated and that carried an anti-cancer drug, and we measured both mortality and viability. And as you can see, mortality, this is the black dark bar, is higher than in all control experiments where we had the pure anti-cancer drug injected in the cell assay and just microgels and microgels that were conjugated with non-specific proteins and peptides, and only in this case we had high mortality. And this was used for the prolonged drug release. In this particular case, we used fast release of anti-cancer drugs, and again, we did many control experiments with doxorubicin, including injection of pure anti-cancer drug that causes bad side effects. And we have to look at this bar where we plotted cell viability, and again, we were having about 50% increase in cell mortality when we are using microgels that were bioconjugated and that carried this drug. I have to say that these microgels were also designed with a specific size because we were using the analogy between, say, uptake of cells, of viruses by cells, and we tried to make our particles with a size smaller than 100 nanometers to mimic the size of viruses. So these are two projects that actually cover my citation. And now I want to move to what we are doing now. What is next? Actually, there are many interesting things around us, and the main problem is to stop at the right time, not to try to cover everything because there are so many interesting things around us. So one of the projects that we have in our group is the development of microfluidic reactors for continuous synthesis of polymer particles. Microfluidics is a very rapidly developing field. This is the flow of liquids through tiny microchannels that have dimensions on the order of, say, 10 to 100 micrometers. And in our work, we are making droplets of polymerizable monomers or prepolymers. And the intrinsic feature of these droplets is that they're extremely monodisperse. And then in the extension channel, we are solidifying them or gelling them and basically having at the end of the microchannel a collector where we're just collecting particles. So actually this microreactor has the size of about 4 inches, and it works continuously. And because these droplets or particles are separated by a well-defined gap, we don't need to use surfactants or stabilizers because they never touch each other, and we collect them when they are already solidified. The main problem in microfluidic reactors is how to scale them up. So now we have hundreds of microchannels working in parallel, and students can do a PhD in 2 years because they don't really participate in the synthesis. They just have to set the system. So this is a joke. Of course, they have to work hard for X number of years. But the advantages of the synthesis is that not that we can make extremely monodispersed particles, as it is shown here, but we can also do polymerization under confinement. And in this way, we can create unique features such as rods or disks or toroids. And this is the intrinsic feature of microfluidic synthesis. By using hydrodynamic means, in addition to thermodynamic factors, we can make particles with unique structures, as it is shown here, capsules and Janus particles that have half of one compound and half of another compound, and then we can do selective bioconjugation, or we can make ball-like particles, and so on. A very nice feature that we can actually transform distance into time, and we can trigger a particular reaction at a particular moment of time. So actually, this gives us wonderful opportunities in not only synthesizing new types of materials, but also in fast throughput screening of reaction conditions, or doing consecutive reactions just by using different energy sources, for example, heating, using irradiation with different wavelengths, using microwaves, and so on. So one of the projects that we are using in our future work is this production of hydrogel capsules. We can make very monodisperse particles from hydrogels, and they have a capsular structure as it is shown here. We can tune their mechanical properties very nicely, and we can also do bioconjugation. So we actually use this particles as surrogate cells to study the or model the behavior of neutrophils in capillaries, blood capillaries, specifically in pulmonary capillaries. And this is the structure of the capillary network. And what we are doing is that we synthesize this hydrogel capsules, we bioconjugate them, we tune their mechanical properties, and then we study how this artificial cells flow through confinement, how they squish when they go through confinement, how they interact with different surfaces if you put different complementary proteins on the surface of these capsules and the channel walls. And we also put them in capillary network or in microchannel network, which can be very easily replicated from the real blood capillaries, and study how multiple artificial cells flow through capillaries and how they behave in a coupled way. And finally, a very interesting project that we have now is the design of biological microenvironments for the growth and differentiation of stem cells. Apparently, the renewal or differentiation of stem cells depends on the number of cells that are in close proximity. So what we are doing is that we fabricate our substrates in a particular way and seed cells on the islands. And by changing the size of islands, we are affecting the number of cells that are in close proximity. And then we look at what should be the critical number of stem cells in this neighborhood in order to renew or differentiate. So apparently, when there is a small number of stem cells in close proximity, they will differentiate, they will produce new lines of cells. While if the number is large enough, they will renew, and this can be used, of course, for tissue engineering. In the next project, we encapsulate different kinds of stem cells in microgel capsules using microfluidics. So these different types of stem cells, say red and green, in this particular example, we can actually tune the number or the ratio between them, models the process of the formation of embryo. And we do very quantitative analysis. In both cases, we do cell assays, and we look at how the fate of stem cells depends on their number that is brought together. So with this, I will give acknowledgments to my wonderful collaborators, both in the Department of Chemistry, in the hospital, Princess Margaret Hospital, and also in the University of North Carolina, and my research group from 1996, when I started as a professor, assistant professor in the Department of Chemistry, University of Toronto, and up to now. Thank you.
You just have to listen to the 5 prize winners of Women in Science UNESCO Laurel Awards. They presented their work in Paris in the Institut de France on the 1st March 2009. Thanks for listening to us. See you soon in Canal Académie.